Travel up there is what's drawing him. Wouldn't it occur to him that it would be easier just to toss us out into the storm and keep the kid for himself? Yeah, maybe. But elves have a peculiar honor. In some way, we'll probably never know how. We did this elf a service by delivering his captain into his hands. His crew witnessed it. He'd lose standing in their eyes by slaughtering us just to make things easier on himself. Honor, then, is important to the elves. Important, Hugh grunted. They'd sell their souls for it, those souls the vultures don't get first. Interesting to know, Haplo stored up the information. His lord was in the market for souls. So we're taking a boatload of elven pirates up to the High Realm. Alfred sighed, then began nervous fussing. Your Highness, you must be tired. Let me put up one of these hammocks. Tripping over a plank, the Chamberlain sprawled face first on the deck. I'm not tired, protested Bane. And don't worry about my father and these elves. My father will take care of them. Don't bother getting up, suggested Hugh to the prostrate Chamberlain. We'll be flying through the maelstrom, and then no one will be on his feet. Everyone sit down and brace yourself. Sound advice. Haplo could see the first storm clouds scudding past. Lightning flashed blindingly. Thunder boomed. The ship began to pitch and buck. The patron relaxed in a corner. The dog curled up, nose to tail, at his feet. Alfred hunched miserably against the bulkhead and pulled a protesting Bane down by the seat of his pants. Only Limbeck remained standing, staring entranced out the porthole. Limbeck, said Haplo, sit down, it's dangerous. I can't believe it, murmured the Geg without turning. There are no gods, and I am going to heaven. Chapter 43, Deep Sky, Mid-Realm. Lieutenant Botherin, now Captain Botherell, sailed the dragon ship safely through the maelstrom. Footnote. Suffixes attached to a name indicate rank. A captain's name ends with L, a lieutenant's name ends with in. A prince, such as Prince Riche, adds the suffix on to his name. End of footnote. Keeping clear of encounters with other elven ships, he steered for the Aristogonian port town of Suthness, a safe haven recommended by Hugh the Hand. Here he planned to stop briefly to take on food and water and to rid his ship of the gear, the former captain's body, and the gear's little box. Hugh knew Suthness well. He had put up there when his ship needed the magic strengthened or repairs. He gave the elf captain the name because he, the Hand, intended to leave the ship himself. The assassin had made up his mind. He cursed the day he met that king's messenger. He cursed the day he had saddled himself with this contract. Nothing had gone right. Now he had lost his own dragon ship, almost his life, and damn near his self-respect. His plan to capture the elven ship had worked, but like everything else he touched these days, not the way it was supposed to. He was to have been the captain, not this elf. Why had he let himself get caught up in that damned duel? Why hadn't he just killed them both? Hugh was shrewd enough to know that if he had fought, he and all the others would probably be dead right now. But he ignored the logic. He refused to admit that he had done what he had done in order to save lives, to protect Alfred, Limbeck, the prince. No, I did it for myself, not for anyone else. No one else matters, and I'll prove it. I'll leave them, disembark at Suthness, let these fools go on to the High Realm and take their chances with the Mysteriarch. Forget it. I'll write off my losses, toss in my cards, get up and leave the table. The port of Suthness was run by elves whose purses meant more to them than politics, and it had become a haven for water smugglers, rebels, deserters, and a few renegade humans. The prisoners had a good view of the town from the porthole, and most, after seeing it, decided they were better off where they were. The town was nothing more than a squalid assemblage of inns and taverns built near the harbor. The homes of the town's inhabitants bunched like a flock of sheep on the side of a coralite cliff. The buildings were shabby and run down. A smell of cooked cabbage, an elven favorite, hung in the air, undoubtedly because mounds of it were rotting in the garbage-infested alleyways. But because it stood in the sun, with blue sky above it, Suthness was a beautiful and awe-inspiring sight to the Geg. Limbeck had never seen streets drenched in sunlight, the firmament glittering like a million jewels in the sky above. He had never seen people strolling about aimlessly, not scurrying hither and yon on some business of the Kixie-Winsie. He had never felt a gentle breeze upon his cheek, or smelled the smells of living, growing things, or even things that were rotting and dying. The houses that Hugh told him were hovels seemed to the Geg to be palaces. Limbeck looked on all this splendor, and it came to him that what he saw had been bought and paid for by the sweat and blood of his people. The Geg's face saddened, he became silent and withdrawn, and Haplo watched with a smile. Hugh paced about the hold, staring out the portholes, fidgeting and inwardly fuming. Captain Botterell had given the assassin permission to leave if he wanted. "You should all go," the captain said. "Leave now while you have the chance."
"But we're going to the High Realm, you promised," Bane cried. "You promised,"
he repeated, gazing up at the elf with pleading eyes. "Yes," said the elf, staring at the child, shaking his head as if to break a hold. He turned to Alfred. "And you?"
"I stay with my prince, of course."
The elf turned to Limbeck, who, not understanding, looked at Haplo.
"I'm going to see the world, the whole world," said the Geg firmly when he heard the translation. "After all, it exists because of my people."
"I'm with him," said the patron, smiling and jerking a bandage-wrapped thumb in the direction of the Geg.
"So," said Botherell, turning to Hugh, "only you are leaving?"
"It looks that way."
Hugh didn't leave, however. While they were docked, one of the midshipmen looked into the brig.
"Are you still aboard, human? The captain is returning. You should go now, quickly."
Hugh didn't move.
"I wish you would come with us, Sir Hugh," said Bane. "My father would like very much to meet you and thank you."
That cinched it. The kid wanted him. He'd leave right now. Right now.
"Well, human," demanded the midshipman, "are you coming?"
Hugh fished around in a pocket, dragged out his last coin, payment for assassinating a child. Grunting, he tossed it at the elf.
"I've decided to stay and find my fortune. Go buy me some tobacco."
The elves did not linger long in Suffness. Once the gear reached civilized lands, he would report the mutiny and the Carfachon would be sought by all the ships of the line. Once in deep sky, Captain Botherell worked the human slaves, the crew, and himself to the point of exhaustion until the ship was, he believed, safely beyond possible pursuit. Hours later, when the Lords of Night had cast their cloak over the sun, the captain found time to speak to his guests.
"So, you heard the news," were the captain's first words, addressed to Hugh. "I want you to know that I could have made a nice profit off the lot of you, but I have a debt to repay to you. I consider at least part of it cancelled."
"Where's my tobacco?" Hugh demanded.
"What news?"
asked Alfred.
The captain raised an eyebrow. "Don't you know? I assume that was the reason you didn't leave the ship."
He tossed a pouch in the assassin's direction. Hugh caught it handily, opened it, and sniffed. Removing his pipe, he began filling it.
"There's a reward out for your head, Hugh the Hand."
Hugh grunted. "Nothing new."
"A total of 200,000 bals."
The Hand looked up and whistled.
"Now that's a fine price. This has to do with the kid?"
His glance shifted to Bane. The child had begged pen and paper from the elves, and had done nothing but draw ever since he came on board. No one interfered with his latest amusement. It was safer than letting him pick berries.
"Yes, you and this man," the elf gestured at Alfred, "are reported to have kidnapped the Prince of Volcarin. There is a price of 100,000 bals on your head," he said to the horrified chamberlain. 200,000 for Hugh the Hand, and the reward is good only if one or both are brought in alive."
"What about me?" Bane raised his head. "Isn't there any reward for me?"
"Stephen doesn't want you back," Hugh growled.
The prince appeared to consider this, then giggled.
"Yes, I guess you're right,"
he said, and returned to his work.
"But this is impossible," cried Alfred. I am His Highness's servant. I came with him to protect him."
"Exactly," said Hugh. "That's just what Stephen didn't want."
"I don't understand any of this," said Captain Botherell. "I hope for your sakes you are being honest about the High Realm. I need money to run this ship and pay my crew, and I've just passed up a lot."
"Of course it's true," cried Bane, lower lip thrust forward in a charming pout. "I am the son of Sinistrad, Mysteriarch of the Seventh House. My father will reward you well."
"He had better," said the captain.
The elf glanced around sternly at his prisoners, then stalked out of the hold. Bane, looking after him, laughed and returned to his scribbling.
"I can never go back to Volcarin," murmured Alfred. "I'm an exile."
"You're dead unless we can figure some way out of this,"
said Hugh, lighting his pipe with a coal from the small mage pot they used to heat their food and to keep themselves warm at night. Footnote, mage pot, an iron pot that holds magical glowstones, used for light and heat. End of footnote.
"But Stephen wants us alive."
"Only so that he can have the pleasure of killing us himself."
Bane, looking up at him, smiled slyly.
"So if you had gone out there, someone would have recognized you and turned you in. You stayed because of me, didn't you? I saved your life."
Hugh made no comment, preferring to pretend that he hadn't heard. He relapsed into a brooding, thoughtful silence. When his pipe went out, he didn't notice. Coming back to himself some time later, he noted that everyone, except Alfred, had fallen asleep.
The Chamberlain was standing beside the porthole, gazing out into night's gray gloom. The hand, rising to stretch his stiff legs, wandered over.
"What do you make of this fellow, Haplow?" Hugh asked.
"Why?"
Alfred jumped, stared at the assassin fearfully.
"Why do you ask?"
"No reason. Calm down. I just wanted to know what you made of him, that's all."
"Nothing. I make nothing of him at all. If you will excuse me, sir..."
Alfred interrupted when Hugh would have spoken.
"I'm very tired. I must get some sleep."
Now, what was that all about? The Chamberlain returned to his blanket. He lay down, but Hugh, watching him, saw that Alfred was far from sleep. He lay stiff and rigid, rubbing his hands, tracing unseen lines upon the skin. His face could have been a mask in a play called Terror and Misery. Hugh could almost pity him. Almost, but not quite. No, the walls Hugh'd built around himself were still standing, still strong and unbroken. There had been a tiny crack, letting in a ray of light, harsh and painful to eyes accustomed to darkness, but he'd blocked it up, covered it over. Whatever hold the child had on him was magic, something beyond the assassin's control, at least until they came to the High Realm. Retreating to a corner of his cell, Hugh relaxed and went to sleep. The flight to the High Realm took the elven dragon ship almost 2 weeks, far longer than it should have, according to Captain Botherell's calculations. What he hadn't calculated on was that his crew and slaves all tired far too quickly. Magical spells cast by the ship's wizard enabled them to withstand the reduced air pressure, but he could do nothing to relieve the thinness of the air that left them always feeling as if they were short of breath. The elven crew grew nervous, sullen, and uneasy. It was eerie flying through the vast and empty sky. Above them, the firmament glittered and sparkled brightly by day, glistened with a pale sheen at night. Even the most gullible person aboard could see that the mysterious firmament was not made of jewels floating in the heavens.
"Chunks of ice," announced Captain Botherell, studying it through the spyglass.
"Ice?"
The second-in-command appeared almost relieved.
"That's stopped us, then, hasn't it, Captain, sir? We can't fly through ice. We might as well turn back."
"No," Botherell snapped his spyglass shut. It seemed he was answering himself, replying to some inner argument rather than to the words of his mate.
"We've come this far. The High Realm is up here somewhere. We're going to find it."
"Or die trying," said the second-in-command, but he said it to himself. On they sailed, higher and higher, drawing nearer the firmament that hung spanning the sky like a monstrous radiant necklace. They saw no sign of life of any type, let alone a land where dwelt the most highly skilled of human magi. The air grew colder. They were forced to wear every article of clothing they possessed, and even then it was difficult to keep warm. The crew began to mutter among themselves that this was mad folly. They would all perish up here, either of the cold or stranded in deep sky, lacking the strength to fly back. After days passed with no sign of life, supplies running short and the cold growing almost unbearable, Captain Botherell went below to tell the guests he had changed his mind. They were returning to the mid-realm. He found the prisoners wrapped in every blanket they could get their hands on, huddled over the mage pot. The Geg was deathly ill, either from the cold or the change in air pressure. The captain didn't know what kept him alive. Alfred did, but took care no one should ask him. Botherell was just about to make his announcement when a shout hailed him.
"What is it?"
The captain ran back to the bridge.
"Have we found it?"
"I'd say, sir,"
said a stammering midshipman, staring with wide eyes out the porthole,
"that it's found us."
Chapter 44. Castle Sinister, High Realm. Iridol stood at the casement, gazing up the crystal window. The beauty of the sight before her was incomparable. The opal walls of her castle glistened in the sunlight, adding to the shimmering colors of the magical dome that was the High Realm's sky. Below the walls, the castle's parks and forests, carefully sculptured and tended, were traversed by pathways whose crushed marble was pricked by glittering gems. Its beauty could stop the heart, but it was long since Iridol had seen beauty in anything. Her name itself, meaning of the rainbow, mocked her. All in her world was gray. As for her heart, it seemed to have stopped beating a long time ago.
"Wife,"
the voice came from behind her. Iridol shivered. She had supposed she was alone in her room. She had not heard the silent padding of slippered feet or the rustling of silken robes that invariably announced the presence of her husband. He had not entered her room for many years, and she felt the chill of his presence grip her heart and squeeze it tightly. Fearfully, she turned around and faced him.
"What do you want?"
Her hand clutched her gown tightly around her, as if the frail fabric might armor her against him.
"Why do you come here to my private quarters?"
Sinistrad glanced at the bed with its flowing curtains and tasseled hangings, its silken sheets smelling faintly of the lavender leaves scattered on them every morning and carefully brushed away each night.
"Since when is a husband forbidden his wife's bedchamber?"
"Leave me alone."
The chill in her heart seemed to have spread to her lips. She could barely move them.
"Do not worry, wife. For 10 cycles I have not come here for the purpose you fear, and I do not intend to resume. Such doings are as repugnant to me as they are you. We might as well all be beasts, rutting in dark and stinking caves. However, it does bring me around to the subject I came to discuss. Our son is coming at last."
"Our son?"
Iridul cried.
"Your son, he is none of mine."
"Let us rejoice," said Sinistrad with a pale, dry smile. "I am glad you take this view of the matter, my dear. I trust you will remember it when the boy arrives, and that you will not interfere with our work."
"What could I possibly do?"
"Bitterness does not become you, wife. Remember, I know your tricks. Tears, pouting, little hugs for the child that you think I will not see. I warn you, Iridul, I will see. My eyes are everywhere, even in the back of my head. The boy is mine. You have pronounced it. Never forget it."
"Tears? Don't fear my tears, husband. They dried up long ago."
"Fear? I am not afraid of anything, least of all you, wife," returned Sinistrad with some amusement. "But you could be an annoyance, confuse the boy's mind. I don't have time to fool with you."
"Why not just lock me up in the dungeon? I am already your prisoner in all but name."
"I had considered it, but the boy would take an undue interest in a mother he is forbidden to see. No, it will be far better if you appear and smile prettily at him. Allow him to see that you are weak and spineless."
"You want me to teach him to despise me?"
Sinistrad shrugged. "I do not aspire to that much, my dear. It will be far better for my plans if he thinks nothing of you at all. And, by good fortune, we have something that will ensure your proper behavior. Hostages. 3 humans and a Geg are his traveling companions. How important it must make you feel, Iridul, to know that you hold so many lives in your hands." The woman's face went livid. Her knees gave way, and she sank into a chair.
"You have sunk low, Sinistrad, but you have never committed murder. I don't believe your threat."
"Let us rephrase that statement, wife. You have never known me to commit murder. But then, let us both admit that you have never known me, period. Good day to you, wife. I will give you notice when you are to appear to greet our son."
Bowing hand over his heart in the time-honored custom of husband and wife, turning even this gesture to one of disdain and mockery, Sinistrad left Iridul's chambers. Shivering uncontrollably, the woman crouched in her chair and stared out the window with dry, burning eyes.
"My father says you are an evil man."
The girl, Iridul, gazed out of a window in her father's dwelling. Standing quite near her, almost touching her, but never coming that close, was a young Mysteriarch. He was the handsome, wicked hero of Iridul's nurse's romantic tales. Smooth, pallid skin, liquid brown eyes that always seemed to be the repository of fascinating secrets. A smile that promised to share these secrets if someone could only draw close enough to him. The black, gilt-edged skullcap that marked his standing as a master of discipline of the 7th house, the highest rank attainable by wizards, dipped to a sharp point that came to the bridge of his thin nose. Sweeping upward between the eyes, the cap gave him an appearance of wisdom and added expression to his face that might otherwise be lacking. He had no eyebrows or eyelashes. His entire body was hairless, a defect of birth.
"Your father is right, Iridul," said Sinistrad softly. Reaching out his hand, he toyed with a strand of her hair, the nearest move to intimacy he ever made. "I am evil. I do not deny it."
There was a touch of melancholy in his voice that melted Iridul's heart as his touch melted her flesh. Turning to face him, she held out her hands, clasped his, and smiled at him.
"No, beloved. The world may call you that, but it is because they don't know you, not as I know you."
"But I am, Iridul."
His voice was gentle and in earnest.
"I tell you the truth now because I don't want you to reproach me with it later. Marry me and you marry darkness."
His finger wound the strand of hair tighter and tighter, drawing her nearer and nearer. His words and the serious tone in which he spoke them made her heart falter painfully. But the pain was sweet and exciting. The darkness that hung over him, dark rumors, dark words spoken about him among the community of Mysteriarchs, was exciting too. Her life, all its 16 years, had been dull and prosaic. Living with a father who doted on her following her mother's death, Illidol had been raised by a grandmotherly nanny. Her father could not bear life's rough winds to blow too harshly against his daughter's tender cheek, and he had kept her sheltered and cloistered, wrapped in a smothering cocoon of love. The butterfly that emerged from that cocoon was bright and shining. Its feeble wings carried it straight into Sinistrad's web.
"If you are evil," she said, twining her hands around his arm, "it is the world that has made you so, by refusing to listen to your plans and thwarting your genius at every turn. When I am walking by your side, I will bring you to the sunlight."
"Then you will be my wife. You will go against your father's wishes?"
"I am of age. I can make my own choice. And, beloved, I choose you."
Sinistrad said nothing, but, smiling his secret, promising smile, he kissed the strand of hair wound tightly around his finger. Illidol lay in her bed, weak from the travails of birth. Her nurse had finished bathing the tiny infant, and, wrapping him in a blanket, carried him to his mother. The occasion should have been one of joy, but the old nurse, who had been Illidol's own, wept when she laid the child in his mother's arms. The door to the bedchamber opened. Illidol made a low moaning sound and clutched the baby so tightly he squalled. The nurse, looking up, smoothed back the woman's sweat-damp curls with gentle hands. A look of defiance hardened the wrinkled face.
"Leave us," said Sinistrad, speaking to the nurse, his gaze fixed upon his wife.
"I will not leave my lamb."
The eyes of the Mysteriarch shifted. The nurse held her ground, though the hand touching Illidol's fair hair trembled. Grabbing hold of the nurse's fingers, Illidol kissed them and bade her leave in a low and tremulous voice.
"I cannot, child."
The nurse began to weep.
"It's cruel what he means to do, cruel and unnatural."
"Get out," Sinistrad snarled, "or I will burn you to ashes where you stand."
The nurse cast him a look of malice, but she withdrew from the room. She knew who would suffer if she did not.
"Now that this is over, she must go, wife," said Sinistrad, coming to stand beside the bed. "I will not be defied in my own house."
"Please, no, husband. She is the only company I have."
Illidol's arms clung to her baby. She looked up at her husband pleadingly, one hand plucking at the blanket.
"And I will need her help with our son. See."
She drew the blanket aside, exhibiting a red, wrinkled face, eyes squinched shut, small fists bunched tightly together.
"Isn't he beautiful, husband?"
She hoped desperately, despairingly, that a glimpse of his own flesh and blood would change his mind.
"He suits my purpose," said Sinistrad, reaching out his hands.
"No."
Illidol shrank away from him.
"Not my child, please don't."
"I told you my intentions the day you announced your pregnancy. I told you then that I had married you for this purpose and this alone, that I had bedded you for the same reason and no other. Give me the child."
Illidol huddled over her baby, her head bowed, her long hair covering the boy in a shining curtain. She refused to look at her husband, as if looking at him gave him power. By shutting her eyes to him, she might make him vanish. But it didn't work, because with her eyes closed, she saw him as he had been that terrible day when her bright illusions of love were completely and irrevocably shattered. The day she had told him her joyous news, that she carried his child within her. That day he had told her in cold and passionless tones what he intended to do with the babe. Illidol should have known he was plotting something. She did know, but wouldn't admit it. On her bridal night, her life had changed from rainbow dreams to gray emptiness. His lovemaking was without love, without passion. He was brisk, businesslike, keeping his eyes open, staring at her intently, willing her to something that she could not understand. Night after night he came to her. During the day he rarely saw her, rarely spoke to her. She grew to dread the night visits and had once ventured to refuse him, begging that he treat her with love. He had taken her that night with violence and pain, and she had never dared refuse him again. Perhaps that very night their child had been conceived. A month later, she knew she was pregnant. From the day she told him, Sinistrad never came to her bedroom again. The child in her arms wailed. Strong hands grabbed Illidol by the hair and jerked her head back. Strong hands wrenched her child from her grasp. Pleading, the mother crawled from her bed and stumbled after her husband as he walked away, their crying infant in his arms. But she was too weak. Tangled in the blood-stained bedclothes, Illidol fell to the floor. One hand caught hold of his robes, dragging him back.
"My baby, don't take my baby."
He regarded her coldly with disgust.
"I told you the day I asked you to be my wife what I was. I have never lied to you. You chose not to believe me, and that is your own fault. You have brought this upon yourself."
Reaching down, he grasped the fabric of his robe and jerked it from her feeble, clutching fingers. Turning, he left the room. When he came back later that night, he brought another baby. The true child born to the wretched king and queen of Volcaron and Eulandia. Sinistrad handed it to Iridol as one might hand over a puppy found abandoned on the road.
"I want my son," she cried, "not the child of some other poor woman."
"Do what you like with it, then," said Sinistrad. His plan had worked well. He was almost in a good humor. "Suckle it, drown it, I don't care." Iridol took pity on the tiny baby, and hoping that the love she lavished on it would be reciprocated on her child so far away, she nursed him tenderly. But the infant could not adapt to the rarefied atmosphere. He died within days, and something within Iridol died, too. Going to Sinistrad a month later in his laboratory, she told him calmly and quietly that she was leaving, returning to the house of her father. In reality, her plan was to go to the mid-realm and take back her child. "No, my dear, I think not," replied Sinistrad, without looking up from the text he was perusing. "My marriage to you lifted the dark cloud from me. The others trust me now. If our plans to escape this realm are to succeed, I'll need the help of all in our community. They must do my will without question. I cannot afford the scandal of a separation from you." He looked up at her then, and she saw that he knew her plans. He knew the secrets of her heart.
"You can't stop me," Iridol cried. "The mysteries I weave are powerful, for I am skilled in magic, as skilled as you, husband, who have devoted your life to your overweening ambition. I will proclaim your evil to the world. They will not follow you, but rise up and destroy you."
"You're right, my dear. I cannot stop you. But perhaps you'd like to discuss this with your father." Keeping a finger on his place in the book, Sinistrad raised his head and made a gesture with his hand. A box of ebony drifted up from the table on which it stood, floated through the air, and came to rest near the wizard's book. Opening it with one hand, he lifted out a silver locket hanging from a rope of black velvet. He held up the locket to Iridol.
"What is it?"
She stared at it suspiciously. "A gift, my dear, from loving husband to loving wife." His smile was a knife twisting in her heart. "Open it." Iridol took the locket with fingers so numb and cold she nearly dropped it. Inside was a portrait of her father. "Take care that you do not drop it or break it," said Sinistrad casually, returning to his reading. Iridol saw in horror that the portrait was staring back at her, its trapped, living eyes pitying, helpless. Sounds outside the window roused Iridol from her melancholy reverie. Rising weakly and unsteadily from the chair, she stared out the casement. Sinistrad's dragon was floating through the clouds, its tail cutting the mist to wispy shreds that trailed away and vanished, like dreams, thought Iridol. The quicksilver dragon had come at Sinistrad's command, and now circled round and round the castle, awaiting its master. The beast was huge, with shining silver skin, a sinuous thin body, and flaring red eyes. It had no wings, but could fly faster without them than could its winged cousins of the mid-realm. Nervous and unpredictable, the most intelligent of their kind, these quicksilver dragons, as they were known, could be controlled only by the most powerful wizards. Even then, the dragon knew it was enthralled, and constantly fought a mental battle with the spellcaster, forcing the magus who enchanted it to be continually on his guard. Iridol watched it out the window. The dragon was always moving, one moment twisting itself into a gigantic coil, rearing its head higher than the tallest castle tower, the next unwinding itself with lightning speed to wrap its long body around the castle's mist-shrouded base. Once Iridol had feared the quicksilver. If it slipped its magical leash, it would kill them all. Now she no longer cared. Sinistrad appeared, and Iridol involuntarily drew back away from the window so that he would not see her if he happened to glance up. He did not look up at her chamber, however, being far more concerned with more important matters. The elven ship had been sighted, the ship carrying his son. He and the others in the council must meet to make final plans and preparations. This was why he was taking the dragon. As a mysteriarch of the seventh house, Sinistrad could have transported himself mentally to the guild hall, dissolving his body and reforming it when the mind arrived at its destination. That had been his means of entry into the mid-realm. Such a feat was taxing, however, and really impressive only if someone was there to see the wizard materialize, supposedly out of thin air. Elves were much more likely to be terrified by the sight of a gigantic dragon than by the refined and delicate techniques of mental spellcasting. Sinistrad mounted the quicksilver, which he had named Gorgon, and it soared into the air and out of Iridol's sight. Her husband had not once looked back. Why should he? He had no fear that she would escape him, not any more. There were no guards posted round the castle. There were no servants posted to watch her and report her doings to their master. He had no need of any, could any have been found. Iridol was her own guard, locked up by her shame, held captive by her terror. Her hand clasped round the locket. The portrait inside was alive no longer. Her father had died some years ago. His soul trapped by Sinistrad, the body had withered away. But whenever Iridol looked at the image of her father's face, she could still see the pity in his eyes. The castle was silent, empty, nearly as silent and empty as her heart. She must dress, she told herself drearily, taking off the night clothes that she wore almost all the time now. The only escape she had was in sleep. Turning from the window, she saw herself in a mirror opposite. 26 cycles. She looked as if she had lived 100. Her hair, that had once been the color of strawberries dipped in golden honey, was now white as the clouds drifting past her window. Lifting a brush, she began to listlessly make some attempt to untangle the matted tresses. Her son was coming. She must make a good impression, otherwise Sinistrad would be displeased. Chapter 45. New Hope, High Realm. Swift as its name, the Quicksilver Dragon bore Sinistrad to New Hope, the capital city of the High Realm. The Mysteriarch was fond of using the dragon to impress his own people. No other wizard had been able to exert a hold over the highly intelligent and dangerous Quicksilver. It would not hurt in this critical time to remind the others once again why they had chosen him to be their leader. Sinistrad arrived in New Hope to find that the magic had already been cast. Shining crystal, towering spires, tree-lined boulevards, he barely recognized the place. Two fellow Mysteriarchs standing outside the council chamber were looking extremely proud of themselves, also extremely fatigued. Dipping down from the sky, Sinistrad gave them time to fully appreciate his mount. Then he released it, ordering the creature to remain within call and await his summons. The dragon opened its fanged mouth in a gaping snarl, its red eyes flamed with hatred. Sinistrad turned his back on the creature.
"I tell you, Sinistrad, someday that dragon's going to break free of the spell you've cast over him, and then none of us will be safe. It was a mistake to capture it," said one of the wizards, an aged Mysteriarch, eyeing the Quicksilver askance.
"Have you so little faith in my power?" inquired Sinistrad in a mild voice. The Mysteriarch said nothing but glanced at his companion. Noting the look pass between them, Sinistrad guessed correctly that they had been discussing him before he came.
"What is it?" he demanded. "Let us be honest with each other. I have always insisted on that, you know."
"Yes, we know. You rub our noses in your honesty," said the old man.
"Come, Balthazar, you know me for what I am. You knew what I was when you voted me your leader. You knew I was ruthless, that I would allow nothing to stand in my way. Some of you called me evil then. You call me that now, and it is an appellation I do not deny. Yet I was the only one among you with vision. I was the one who devised a plan to save our people. Isn't that so?"
The Mysteriarchs looked at Sinistrad, glanced at each other, then looked away, one turning his gaze on the beautiful city, the other watching the Quicksilver Dragon vanish into the cloudless sky.
"Yes, we agree," said one.
"We had no choice," added the other.
"Not very complimentary, but then I can do without compliments. Speaking of which, the work you have done is excellent."
Sinistrad gave the spires, the boulevards, the trees a critical inspection. Reaching out his hand, he touched the stone of the building before which they were standing.
"So good, in fact, I was forced to wonder if this wasn't all part of it as well. I was half afraid to enter."
One of the Mysteriarchs smiled bleakly at the wizard's little essay into humor. The other, the old man, scowled, turned, and left him. Gathering his robes about him, Sinistrad followed his companions, ascending the marble stairs and passing through the glittering crystal doors of the Wizard's Guild Hall. Inside the hall, talking in solemn and hushed voices, were gathered about 50 wizards. Male and female, they were clad in robes similar to Sinistrad's in make and design, although widely varying in color. Each hue designated a wizard's particular devotion: green for the land, deep blue for the sky, red for fire, or magic of the mind, light blue for water. A few, such as Sinistrad, wore the black that stood for discipline. Iron discipline, the discipline that admitted no weakness. When he strode into the room, those present who had been conversing together in low, excited voices fell silent. Each bowed and stepped aside, forming an opening in their ranks through which he walked. Glancing about him, nodding to friends here, noting enemies there, Sinistrad moved without haste through the large hall. Made of marble, the guild hall was bleak, empty, and unadorned. No tapestries graced its walls, no statues decorated its doorways. No windows admitted the sunlight, no magic dispelled the gloom. The dwellings of the Mysteriarchs in the Mid-Realm had been renowned throughout the world as the most marvelous of all human creations. Remembering the beauty from which they had come, the wizards found the starkness and austerity of the Guild Hall in the High Realm chilling. Hands thrust into the sleeves of their robes, they stood well away from the walls and appeared to try to avoid looking anywhere except at each other or their leader, Sinistrad. He was the youngest among them. Every Mysteriarch there could remember him first entering the guild hall, a well-built youth inclined to be servile and sniveling. His parents had been among the earliest of the exiles to succumb up here, leaving him orphaned. The others felt sorry for the young man, but not unduly. There were, after all, many orphans at that time. Immersed in their own problems, which were monumental, no one had paid much attention to the young wizard. Human wizards had their own version of history that was, much like any other race's history, distorted by their own perspective. Following the sundering, the Sartan had brought the people, not first to Aristagon, as the elves would have it, but here, to this realm beneath a magical dome. The humans, particularly the wizards, worked extremely hard to make this realm not only habitable but beautiful. It seemed to them that the Sartan were never around to help, but were always off somewhere on important business. On the infrequent occasions when the Sartan returned, they lent their assistance, utilizing their rune magic. Thus it was that fabulous buildings were created, the dome was strengthened, the coralite bore fruit, water was in abundance. The human wizards were not particularly grateful, they were envious, they coveted the rune magic. Then came the day when the Sartan announced the mid-realm below was suitable for habitation. Humans and elves were transported to Aristagon, while the Sartan remained above in the high realm. The Sartan gave the reason for the move, the fact that the domed land was getting too crowded. The human wizards believed that the Sartan had cast them out because the wizards were becoming too knowledgeable about the rune magic. Time passed, and the elves grew strong and united under their powerful wizards, and the humans turned into barbaric pirates. The human wizards watched the rise of the elves with outward disdain and inward fear. They said to themselves, if only we had the rune magic, then we could destroy the elves. Instead of helping their own people, therefore, they began to concentrate their magic on finding ways to return to the high realm. At length, they succeeded, and a large force of the most powerful magi, the Mysteriarchs, ascended to the high realm to challenge the Sartan and take back what they had come to see as rightfully their land. This the humans called the War of Ascension, only it wasn't much of a war. The Mysteriarchs woke one morning to find the Sartan gone, their dwellings empty, their cities abandoned. The wizards returned victorious to their people, only to find the mid-realm in chaos, torn by war. It was all they could do to manage to stay alive, much less try to use their magic to move the people to the promised land. Finally, after years of suffering and hardship, the Mysteriarchs were able to leave the mid-realm and enter the land their legends held was beautiful, bountiful, safe, and secure. Here, too, they hoped to discover at last the secrets of the runes. It all seemed a wonderful dream. It would soon turn to a nightmare. End of side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. The runes kept their secrets, and the Mysteriarchs discovered to their horror how much of the beauty and bounty of the land had depended on the runes. Crops grew, but not in the numbers needed to feed the people. Famine swept the land. Water was scarce and became scarcer, each family having to expend immense amounts of magic in order to produce it. Centuries of inbreeding had already weakened the wizards, and further inbreeding in this closed realm produced frightful genetic defects that could not be cured with magic. These children died, and eventually few children were born. Most horrifying, it became obvious to the Mysteriarchs that the magic of the dome was fading. They would have to leave this realm, yet how could they, without proclaiming their failure, their weaknesses? One man had an idea. One man told them how it could be done. They were desperate. They listened. As time passed and Sinistrad did well in his magical studies, surpassing many of the elders in his power, he ceased to be servile and began to flaunt his abilities. His elders were displeased and disgusted when he changed his name to Sinistrad, but they thought little of it at the time. Back in the mid-realm, a bully might call himself Brute or Thug or some other tough-sounding name in order to garner respect he hadn't earned. It meant nothing. The Mysteriarchs had ignored the name change, just as they had ignored Sinistrad. Oh, a few spoke out, Irritel's father being one of them. A few tried to make their fellows see the young man's overweening ambition, his ruthless cruelty, his ability to manipulate. Those who spoke the warnings were not heeded. Irritel's father lost his only loved daughter to the man, and lost his life in Sinistrad's magical captivity. None of the wizards knew that, however. The prison had been created so skillfully that no one ever noticed. The old wizard walked about the land, visited his friends, performed his duties. If any remarked that he seemed listless and sorrowful, all knew he grieved over his daughter's marriage. None knew that the old man's soul had been held hostage like a bug in a glass jar. Imperceptibly, patiently, the young wizard cast his web over all the surviving wizards of the high realm. The filaments were practically invisible, light to the touch, barely felt. He didn't weave a gigantic web for all to see, but deftly wrapped a line around an arm, wound a toil around a foot, holding them so lightly that they never knew they were held at all until the day came when they couldn't move. Now they were stuck fast, caught by their own desperation. Sinistrad was right. They had no choice. They had to rely on him, for he was the only one who had been smart enough to plan ahead
and make some provision to escape their beautiful hell. Sinistrad arrived at the front of the hall. He caused a golden podium to spring up from the floor, and, mounting it, turned to address his fellows. The elf ship has been sighted. My son is aboard. In accordance with our plans, I shall go to meet and guide it. We never agreed to allow an elven vessel inside the dome, spoke out a female Mysteriarch. You said it would be a small ship piloted by your son and his oafish servant. I was forced to effect a change in plans, replied Sinistrad, his lips creasing in a thin and unpleasant smile. The first ship was attacked by elves and crashed on Drevlin. My son was able to take over this elven vessel. The child holds their captain in thrall. There are no more than 30 elves on board the ship, and only one wizard, a very weak wizard, of course. I think we can deal with that situation, don't you?
Yes, in the old days, answered a woman. One of us could have dealt with 30 elves, but now...
Her voice trailed away as she shook her head. That is why we have worked our magic, created the illusions. Sinistrad gestured toward the outside of the guild hall. They will be intimidated by the sight alone. We will have no trouble from them.
Why not meet them at the firmament? Take your son and let them go on their way,
demanded the aged Mysteriarch known as Balthazar. Because, you doddering fool, we need their vessel, Sinistrad hissed, clearly growing angry at the questioning. With it we can transport large numbers of our people back down to the Mid-Realm. Before, we would have been forced to wait until we could either acquire vessels or enchant more dragons.
So what do we do with the elves? Asked the woman.
Everyone looked to Sinistrad. They knew the answer as well as he did. They wanted to hear him say it. He said it without pause, without hesitation. We kill them. The silence was loud and echoing. The aged Mysteriarch shook his head.
No, I won't be a party to this.
Why not, Balthazar? You killed elves enough back in the Mid-Realm.
That was war. This is murder.
War is us or them. This is war. It is either us or them. The Mysteriarchs around him murmured, seeming to agree. Several began to argue with the old wizard, trying to persuade him to change his stance. Sinistrad is right, they said. It is war. It can never be anything else between our races. And, after all, Sinistrad's only trying to lead us home.
I pity you, Balthazar snarled. I pity you all. He,
pointing at Sinistrad,
is leading you all right, leading you around by the nose like fatted calves. And when he's ready to dine, he'll slaughter the lot of you and feed off your flesh. Leave me alone. I'll die up here sooner than follow him back there.
The old wizard stalked toward the door. And so you will, Greybeard, muttered Sinistrad beneath his breath. Let him go, he said aloud when some of his fellows would have gone after the wizard, unless there are any others who want to leave with him.
The Mysteriarch cast a swift, searching glance around the room, gathering up the tendrils of his web and tugging it tighter and tighter. No one else managed to break free. Those who had once struggled were now so weak with fear they were eager and ready to do his bidding. Very well. I will bring the elven ship through the dome. I will remove my son and his companions to my castle. Sinistrad might have told his people that one of his son's companions was a skilled assassin, a man who could take the blood of the elves on his own hands and leave those of the Mysteriarchs clean.
But Sinistrad wanted to harden his people, force them to sink lower and lower until they would willingly and unquestioningly do anything he asked. Those of you who volunteered to learn to fly the elf ship know what you are to do. The rest must work to maintain the city's spells. When the time comes, I will give the signal and we will act. He gazed at them all, studied each pallid, grim face, and was satisfied. Our plans are progressing well. Better than we had anticipated, in fact. Traveling with my son are several who may be of use to us in ways we had not foreseen. One is a dwarf from the Low Realm. The elves have exploited the dwarves for centuries. It is likely we can turn the Geggs, as they call themselves, to war. Another is a human who claims to come from a realm beneath the Low Realm, a realm none of us previously knew existed. This news could be extremely valuable to all of us. There were murmurs of approval and agreement. My son brings information about the human kingdoms and the elven revolution, all of which will be most helpful when we set about to conquer them. And most important, he has seen the great machine built by the Sartan on the Low Realm. At last we may be able to unravel the mystery of the so-called Kixi Winzi and turn it, too, to our use. Sinistrad raised his hands in a blessing. Go forth now, my people. Go forth and know that as you do so, you are stepping out into the world, for soon Arianus will be ours.
The meeting broke up with cheering, most of it enthusiastic. Sinistrad stepped down from the podium and it disappeared. Magic had to be carefully rationed, expended only on that which was essential. Many stopped him to congratulate him or to ask questions, clearing up small details about the plan of action. Several asked politely after his health, but no one inquired about his wife. Iridol had not been present at a council meeting in 10 cycles, ever since the guild voted to go along with Sinistrad's plot to take her child and exchange it for the human prince. The guild members were just as well pleased Iridol did not attend the meetings. They still, after all this time, found it difficult to look into her eyes. Sinistrad, mindful of the need to commence his journey, shook off the hangers-on who crowded round him and made his way from the guild hall. A mental command brought the quicksilver dragon to the very foot of the stairs of the hall. Glowering at the wizard balefully, the dragon nevertheless suffered the Mysteriarch to mount its back and command it to do his bidding. The dragon had no choice but to obey Sinistrad. It was enthralled. In this, the creature was unlike the wizards standing in the shadowy doorway of the guild hall. They had given themselves to Sinistrad of their own free will. Chapter 46. The Firmament. The elven dragon ship hung motionless in the thin, chill air. Having reached the floating chunks of ice known as the firmament, it had come to a halt, no one daring to proceed further. Ice floes 10 times larger than the vessel loomed above them. Smaller boulders circled the more massive chunks. The air glistened with tiny droplets of frozen water. The sun's glare off the flowbergs dazzled the eye. No one could look at them directly without being blinded. How thick the firmament was, how far it reached, was anyone's guess. No one, except the Mysteriarchs and the Sartan, had ever flown this high and returned to give an account of their journey. Maps had been drawn from speculation, and now everyone on board ship knew them to be inaccurate. No one had guessed the Mysteriarchs had passed through the firmament to build their realm on the other side.
"Natural defense barrier," said Hugh, peering with narrowed eyes at the awful beauty outside the porthole. "No wonder they've kept their wealth undisturbed all these years."
"How do we get through it?" asked Bane. The child was standing on tiptoe to see.
"We don't."
"But we have to," the prince's voice shrilled. "I have to get to my father."
"Kid, one of the ice boulders, even a little one, hits us, and our bodies will be just another star twinkling in the daytime sky. Maybe you better tell Daddy to come get you."
Bane's face smoothed, the flush of anger faded. "Thank you for the suggestion, Sir Hugh."
His hand clasped around the feather.
"I'll do just that. And I'll be certain to tell him all you've done for me. All of you." His glance encompassed everyone from Alfred to a beauty-dazed Limbeck to Haplo's dog. "I'm certain he'll reward you, as you deserve."
Skipping across the deck, Bane plunked himself down in a corner of the hold, and closing his eyes, apparently began to commune with his father.
"I didn't like that little pause he put in between reward and deserve," remarked Haplo. "What's to keep this wizard from snatching his kid and sending us up in flames?"
"Nothing, I suppose," answered Hugh, "except that he wants something, and it's not just his little boy. Otherwise, why go to all this trouble?"
"Sorry, you've lost me."
"Alfred, come here. Look, you said that this Sinistrad came to the castle at night, switched babies, and then left. How'd he manage that with guards all around?"
"The Mysteriarchs have the power to transport themselves through the air. Tryon explained it thus to His Majesty the King. The spell is done by means of sending the mind on ahead of the body. Once the mind is firmly established in a particular location, it can call for the body to join it. The only requirement of the spellcaster is that he must have previously visited the place so that he can mentally call up an accurate picture of where he's going. The Mysteriarchs had often visited the royal palace on New Alandia, which is nearly as old as the world."
"But he couldn't, for example, send himself to the Low Realm or the Elven Palace on Aristagon."
"No, sir, he couldn't. Not mentally, at least. None of them could. The elves hated and feared the Mysteriarchs and never allowed them in their kingdom. The wizards couldn't travel to the Low Realm that way either, since they'd never been there before. They'd have to rely on other means of transport."
"Oh, I see your point, sir."
"Uh-huh. First Sinistrad tried to get my ship. That failed, and now he has this one. If he..."
"Hush, company," murmured Haplo.
The door to the brig opened, and Captain Botharel, flanked by 2 crew members, entered.
"You," he pointed to Hugh, "come with me."
Shrugging, the hand did as he was told, not sorry to get a glimpse of what was going on above. The door slammed shut behind them, the guard locked it, and Hugh followed the elf up the ladder to the top deck. It was not until he arrived on the bridge that he noticed Haplo's dog trotting at his heels.
"Where did that come from?"
The captain glared at the animal irritably. The dog gazed up at him, brown eyes shining, tongue lolling, tail wagging.
I don't know. He followed me, I guess. Midshipman, get that thing off the bridge. Take it back to its master and tell him to keep an eye on it, or I'll toss it overboard.
Yes, sir.
The midshipman bent down to pick up the dog. The animal's demeanor changed instantly. Its ears flattened and the tail ceased wagging and began a slow and ominous brush from side to side. The lips parted in a snarl, a low growl rumbled in the chest. If you are fond of those fingers, the animal seemed to say, you better keep them to yourself. The midshipman took the dog's advice. Putting his hands behind his back, he looked questioningly and fearfully at his captain.
Dog,
cried Hugh experimentally. The animal's ears lifted slightly. It glanced at him, keeping one eye fixed on the midshipman, but letting Hugh know it considered him a friend.
Here, dog,
ordered Hugh, clumsily snapping his fingers. The dog turned his head, asking him if he was sure about this. Hugh snapped his fingers again, and the dog, with a parting snarl of the hapless elf, ambled over to Hugh, who patted it awkwardly. It sat down at his feet.
It'll be all right. I'll watch him.
Captain, the dragon is closing on us, reported a lookout.
Dragon?
Hugh looked at the elf. Captain Botherell, in answer, pointed. Hugh walked over to the ship's porthole and stared out. Threading its way through the firmament, the dragon was barely visible, appearing as a river of silver flowing among the Flobergs, a river of silver with two flaming red eyes.
Do you know its type, human?
A quicksilver. Hugh had to pause to think of the elven word.
Cylindistani.
We can't outrun it, said Captain Botherell. Look at its speed. It is well named. We'll have to fight.
I don't think so, offered Hugh. My guess is we're about to meet the boy's father.
Elves dislike and distrust dragons intensely. The elf wizard's magic cannot control them, and the knowledge that humans can has always throbbed like a rotting tooth in the elven mouth. The elves aboard the ship were nervous and ill at ease in the presence of the quicksilver dragon. It wound and writhed and twisted its long, shining body around their vessel. The elves shifted their heads constantly to keep the creature in view, or jumped in startlement whenever the head shot up in a place where it had not been 2 seconds earlier. Such nervous reactions appeared to amuse the Mysteriarch standing on the bridge. Though the wizard was graciousness itself, Hugh could see the glint beneath the lashless eyelids, and a small smile flickered occasionally across the thin and bloodless lips.
I am eternally in your debt, Captain Botherell, said Sinistrad. My child means more to me than all the treasures of the High Realm.
Looking down at the boy who was clinging to his hand and gazing up at him in unfeigned admiration, Sinistrad enlarged his smile.
I was glad to be of service. As the boy explained, we are now considered outlaws by our people. We must find and join the rebel forces. He promised us payment.
Oh, and you will receive it in abundance, I assure you. And you must see our enchanting realm and meet our people. We have so few guests. We become quite weary of each other. Not that we encourage visitors, Sinistrad added delicately, but this is a special circumstance.
Hugh glanced at Haplow, who had been brought to the bridge with the other guests upon Sinistrad's arrival. The assassin would have liked very much to get some indication of what Haplow thought of all this. They couldn't speak, of course, but even a raised eyebrow or a quick wink would tell Hugh that Haplow wasn't swallowing this honeyed fruit either. But Haplow was staring at Sinistrad so intently, the man might have been counting the pores in the wizard's long nose.
I will not risk flying my ship through that, Captain Botherell indicated the firmament with a nod of his head. Give us what you have.
The elf's gaze fixed on several fine jewels adorning the fingers of the Mysteriarch, and we will return to our realm. Hugh could have told the elf he was wasting his breath. Sinistrad would never let this ship slip through his ruby and diamond sparkling hands. He didn't.
The journey might be the tiniest bit difficult, Captain, but not impossible and certainly not dangerous. I will be your guide and show you the safe passage through the firmament.
He glanced around the bridge.
Surely you will not refuse to allow your crew the chance to view the wonders of our realm.
The legendary wealth and splendor of the High Realm, made real by the sight of the jewels the wizard wore with such careless ease, kindled a flame that burned up fear and, so Hugh saw in the crew's eyes, common sense. He felt a cool pity for the elven captain, who knew he was flying into a spider web, but who could do nothing to stop himself. If he gave the order to leave this place and return home, he'd be the one returning the hard way, head over heels through several miles of empty sky.
Very well, Botherell said ungraciously. A cheer from the crew died out with the flash in the captain's eye.
May I ride with you on the dragon, Papa?
Asked Bane.
Of course, my son. Sinistrad ran a hand through the boy's fair hair. And now, much as I would enjoy staying and talking further with all of you, especially my new friend Limbeck here, Sinistrad bowed to the geg who bobbed awkwardly back. My wife is waiting most impatiently to see her child. Women, what loving little creatures they are. Sinistrad turned to the captain. I have never flown a ship, but it occurs to me that the major problem you will encounter passing through the firmament is ice forming on the wings. I am certain, however, that this most skilled colleague of mine, he bowed to the ship's wizard who returned the courtesy respectfully, if guardedly, can melt it. His arm around his son, Sinistrad started to leave, using his magic to transport him the short distance back to the dragon. Their bodies had faded to almost nothing when he paused and fixed a glittering-eyed gaze upon the captain. Follow the path of the dragon, he said. Exactly. And he was gone.
So what do you think of him?
Hugh asked Haplo in an undertone as both men, plus the dog, Alfred, and Limbeck, were escorted back to the brig. The wizard? Who else?
Oh, he's powerful, said Haplo, shrugging, but not as powerful as I'd expected.
Hugh grunted. He'd found Sinistrad daunting.
And what did you expect? A Sartan?
Haplo glanced sharply at Hugh, saw it was a joke. Yeah, he answered, grinning. Chapter 47. The Firmament. The Carpha Shon sailed through the ice floes, leaving a sparkling trail of crystals swirling and glittering in its wake. The cold was bitter. The ship's wizard had been forced to draw magical heat from the living and working areas of the ship and use it to keep the rigging, the cables, the wings, and the hull free of the ice that rained down on them with a rattling noise, sounding so, Limbeck said, like millions of dried peas. Haplo, Limbeck, Alfred, and Hugh huddled for warmth around the small brazier in the hold. The dog had curled up in a ball, its nose buried in its bushy tail, and was fast asleep. None of the four spoke. Limbeck was too awed by the sights he had seen and expected to see. What Haplo might be thinking was anybody's guess. Hugh was considering his options. Murder is out. No assassin worth his dagger takes on the job of killing a wizard, let alone a Mysteriarch. This Sinistrad is powerful. What am I saying? This man is power itself. He hums with it like a lightning rod in a thunderstorm. If only I could figure out why he wants me now, when he tried to kill me once before. Why am I suddenly so valuable?
Why did you make me bring Hugh, Father?
The Quicksilver Dragon threaded its way through the ice floes. It was moving with unusual slowness, being held back by Sinistrad so that the elven ship could follow. The lethargic pace irritated the dragon, who, in addition, would have liked very much to dine on the sweet-smelling creatures inside the ship. But it knew better than to challenge Sinistrad. The two had waged numerous magical battles before, and Gorgon had always lost. It hated the wizard with a grudging respect. I may need Hugh the Hand, Bane. He is a pilot, after all.
But we have a pilot, the elf captain.
My dear child, you have much to learn. So begin learning it now. Never trust elves. Though their intelligence is equal to that of humans, they are longer lived and tend to gain in wisdom. In ancient days, they were a noble race, and humans were, as the elves are wont to sneer, little more than animals compared to them. But the elf wizards could not leave well enough alone. They were, in fact, jealous of us.
I saw the wizard take the dead elf's soul,
interrupted Bane, hushed with remembered awe. Yes, Sinistrad sneered. That was how they thought to fight us.
I don't understand, Father.
It is important that you do, my son, and quickly, for we will be dealing with an elven ship's wizard. Let me describe to you briefly the nature of magic. Before the sundering, spiritual and physical magic, like all other elements in the world, was blended together in all people. After the sundering, the world was split into its separate elements, at least so the legends of the Sartan tell us, and this happened with magic. Each race naturally seeks to use the power of magic to make up for its own deficiencies. Thus, elves, tending naturally toward the spiritual, needed magic to help enhance their physical powers. They studied the art of granting magical powers to physical objects that could work for them.
Like the dragon ship?
Yes, like the dragon ship. Humans, on the other hand, were better able to control the physical world, and so sought additional power through the spiritual. To communicate with animals, to force the wind to do our bidding, the stones to rise up at our command, this became our greatest talent. And because of our concern with the spiritual, we developed the ability of mental magic, of training our minds to alter and control physical laws.
That's why I could fly.
Yes. And if you had been an elf, you would have lost your life, for they do not possess such power. The elves poured all of their arcane skill into physical objects and studied the art of mental manipulation. An elven wizard with his hands bound is helpless, A human wizard, under the same circumstances, need simply tell himself that his wrists are shrinking in size, and it will be true. Thus, he can slip out of his bonds.
Father, said Bane, looking backward, the ship's stopped.
So it has. Sinistrad checked an impatient sigh and reined in the dragon. That ship's wizard of theirs must be nothing more than second house if he can't keep the ice off their wings any better than this.
And so we have two pilots.
Bane twisted around in the dragon saddle in order to get a better look at the ship. The elves had been forced to take axes to the ice that had formed on the cables. Not for long, said Sinistrad. If he's going to use this vessel, the wizard needs a pilot. This question settled, Hugh took out his pipe and began to fill it sparingly with his dwindling supply of tobacco. And now the wizard has two pilots, me and the elf. He can keep us both guessing, play us one off the other. Winner lives, loser dies. Or maybe not. Maybe he won't trust the elf at all. Interesting. I wonder if I should tip off Botharell. Lighting his pipe, Hugh gazed at the others from beneath hooded lids. Limbeck. Why Limbeck? And Haplo, where does he fit in? The Geg you brought, my son. You say he's the leader of his people?
Well, sort of.
Bane squirmed uncomfortably.
It wasn't my fault. I tried to get their king. They call him the head foreman.
High Froman.
But that other man wanted this Limbeck to come and...
The boy shrugged.
He came.
What other man? Sinistrad asked. Alfred?
No, not Alfred. Bane said scornfully. The other man, the quiet one, the one with the dog.
Sinistrad cast his mind around the bridge of the ship. He did recall seeing some other human, but couldn't bring his face to memory. Nondescript, a kind of gray blur. That must be the one from the newly discovered realm. Perhaps you should have cast the enchantment over him, convinced him that he wanted what you wanted. Didn't you try?
Of course, Father,
Bane said, his cheeks flushed with indignation. Then what happened? Bane ducked his head.
It didn't work.
What? Could it be possible that Tryon actually managed to disrupt the spell? Or perhaps this man has a charm.
No, he doesn't have anything except a dog. I don't like him. He came along and I didn't want him to, but I couldn't stop him. When the enchantment went out to him, it didn't work like it does on most people. Everyone else sort of absorbs it, like a sponge sucking up water. With him, that Haplo, it just bounced right back.
Impossible. He must have a hidden charm, or else it was your imagination.
No, it wasn't either of those, Father.
Bah, what do you know? You're just a child. This Limbeck is the leader of some sort of rebellion among the people, isn't that right? Bane, head down, pouted, refused to answer. Sinistrad brought the dragon to a halt. The ship was lumbering along behind, its wings brushing the edges of floebergs that could smash its hull into fragments. Twisting in the saddle, the Mysteriarch caught hold of his son's jaw with his hand and jerked the boy's face upward. His grip was painful, Bane's eyes filled with tears. You will answer promptly any question I put to you. You will do my bidding without argument or backtalk. You will at all times treat me with respect. I do not blame you for your lack of it now. You have been around those who did nothing to command it, who were not worthy of it, but that has changed. You are with your father now. Never forget that.
No,
whispered Bane. No what? The grip tightened.
No, Father,
Bane gasped. Satisfied, Sinistrad released the boy, rewarding Bane with a slight widening of the thin, bloodless lips. He turned back to face forward, ordering the dragon on. The wizard's fingers left white indentations on the boy's cheek, purplish marks on his jaw. Thoughtful, Bane was silent, trying to rub away the pain with his hand. His tears had not fallen, and he blinked them back from his eyes, swallowed those in his throat. Now answer my question. This Limbeck is leader of a rebellion.
Yes, Father.
And so he could be useful to us. At the very least, he will provide information about the machine.
I made drawings of the machine, Father.
Did you? Sinistrad glanced behind him. Good ones? No, don't take them out. They might blow away. I will look them over when we reach home. Hugh puffed slowly on his pipe, feeling more relaxed. Whatever the wizard was plotting, Limbeck would provide him information and access to the low realm. But Haplo, try to figure that one. Unless he just came along by accident. No. Hugh gazed at the man intently. Haplo was teasing the sleeping dog, tickling its nose with its tail. The dog sneezed, woke up, looked around irritably for the fly, and, not finding it, went back to sleep. Hugh thought back to their imprisonment on Drevlin, to the riveting shock he'd experienced seeing Haplo standing beside the grill. No, Hugh couldn't imagine Haplo doing anything by accident. This was by design, then. But by whose? Hugh's gaze shifted to Alfred.
The Chamberlain was staring into nothing, his face the face of one who walks in a waking nightmare. What had happened to him in the low realm, and why was he here, other than that the kid wanted to bring along his servant? But Bane hadn't brought Alfred, Hugh remembered. The Chamberlain had tagged along of his own accord, and was still tagging. "And what about Alfred?" Sinistrad asked. "Why did you bring him?" The Mysteriarch and his son were nearing the edge of the firmament. The bergs were becoming smaller, and the distances between them farther apart. Ahead of them, sparkling in the distance, shining through the ice like an emerald set amidst diamonds, was what Sinistrad said was the High Realm. In the distance, behind them, they could hear a ragged cheer lift from the elven ship. "He found out about King Stephen's plan to have me murdered," Bane answered his father, "and he came along to protect me."
"He doesn't know more than that."
"He knows I'm your son. He knows about the enchantment."
"All the fools know about it. That's what made it so effective. They were so delightfully aware of their own helplessness. But that wasn't what I meant. Does Alfred know you manipulated your parents and that idiot Tryon into thinking that they were the ones responsible for casting you out? Is that why he came?"
"No. Alfred came because he can't help himself. He has to be with me. He's not smart enough to do anything else."
"It will be handy to have him with you when you return. He can verify your story."
"Return? Return where?" Bane looked frightened. He clung to his father. "I'm going to stay with you."
"Why don't you rest now? We'll be home soon, and I want you to make a good impression on my friends."
"And on Mother?"
Bane settled himself more comfortably in the saddle. "Yes, of course. Now hold your tongue. We are nearing the dome, and I must communicate with those waiting to receive us." Bane rested his head against his father's back. He hadn't told quite all the truth about Alfred. There had been that strange occurrence in the forest when the tree fell on the boy. Alfred thought I was still unconscious, but I wasn't. I saw. Just what it was I saw, I'm not certain. Up here, I'm sure to find out. Perhaps someday I'll ask Father. But not now. Not until I learn what he meant about returning. Until then, I'll keep Alfred all to myself. Bane nestled closer to Sinistrad. Hugh dumped the tobacco out of his pipe, and, wrapping it carefully in its cloth, placed it snugly against his breast. He'd known all along he was making a mistake coming up here. But he couldn't help himself. The kid had ensorcelled him. Hugh decided he could, therefore, quit thinking about his options. He didn't have any. Chapter 48. New Hope, High Realm. Guided by the Mysteriarch and the Quicksilver Dragon, the Carver Sean sailed through the magical dome surrounding the High Realm. Elves, humans, and the Geg pressed their faces against the portholes, staring out at the marvelous world below them. They were dazzled by the extraordinary beauty, awestruck by the magnificence of what they saw, and each reminded himself uneasily just how powerful were the beings who created these marvels. Within seconds, they had left behind the world of frozen, glittering ice and entered a sun-warmed green land with a shimmering, rainbow-hued sky. The elves shed the fur coats they had donned to combat the frigid cold. Hugh dumped the charwood out of the brazier into the firebox. The ice began to melt from the ship, pouring off the hull, falling to the ground below them like rain.